Dr. Gene Gordon of Bell Telephone Labs, who will present a review of tube-type video imaging devices. Gene?
This session is devoted to electron beam scanned diode arrays, an emerging technology, as Ralph said, but which is so old conceptually that it has been said that we stole it from the Indians. In this age, it's important to acknowledge the contributions of minority groups. So the first slide will show the Indian that we stole it from. Killed my joke. This photograph was taken of a monitor display. The pickup tube used to take the picture is appropriately a silicon target camera tube. Superimposed on the Indian is a large number of white spots or defects. I guess the next paper by Jim Matthews will partially devote itself to what is being done or to what these defects are. I suspect the following two speakers will gracefully skirt around the issue. My talk will be about why we're not ready to give it back to the Indians. So that's why I've chosen to review camera tubes, in a sense, to set the stage for some kind of comparison. Pickup or conversion tubes transduce spatial variations in a flux of photons or charged particles into a representative electrical signal. The flux density is sampled along a prescribed path called a raster, and one complete path is called a video frame. Some applications require only one video frame. More frequently, such as in television, a continuous sequence of frames is required. Common to all modern sensitive pickup tubes is a charge storage target, and this is shown in the second slide. We have a beam forming a cathode, a gun, deflection means, and a decelerating mesh, and some kind of insulator structure. This could be a dielectric. It could even be air in some applications. A conducting backplate, which is sometimes transparent. It might be transparent to photons. It might be transparent to electrons. And a biasing structure, which places the potential of the backplate relatively close to the potential of the cathode. The decelerating mesh serves the function of allowing the electron stream to approach the target very closely at high velocity, and then drastically decelerate in a very short distance, typically 100 mils, before striking the storage surface at low energy. And because of this close distance, the defocusing of the beam is minimal, and one can get a relatively tightly focused beam. Now, the characteristic of the low-energy scanning is such as to establish an equilibrium charging potential on the surface. I will get back to that point in a moment. I merely want to point out that the surface, however the charge is created, whether on the surface or within the volume of the storage medium, preserves the spatial integrity of the holes, in other words, of the charges. In other words, any leakage laterally takes place in a time which is long compared to any time of interest. And in the process of scanning the surface, the electron beam restores it to an equilibrium charging potential. The charging current flows in the external circuit from ground back to the cathode, and that current flowing in a sensing resistor constitutes the video signal. So we have an analog signal representative of the point-by-point charge storage along a prescribed path, and together with appropriate syncing means and so on, we have a video signal. Now, a very important characteristic of any such system is illustrated on the next slide, namely that the current to the surface is a very strong function of the potential of that surface relative to the cathode from which the beam originates. The characteristics at low landing energy, namely when the surface is essentially at the same potential as cathode, the electrons still have a finite velocity because they have been emitted with finite velocity from a hot cathode, approach the surface and are generally elastically reflected very efficiently. So there's a relatively low current onto the storage surface at this potential. As the energy of landing increases, more and more the electrons stick. In other words, the elastic reflection is less efficient. And also, you begin to produce secondary electrons coming off the target, so that ultimately we have a situation where secondary electrons coming off tend to decrease the sticking probability of electrons, and in fact, at high enough velocity or voltage, the current actually reverses sign. More electrons come off than go on. This optimum or maximum here is a result of the increasing secondary emission and the decreasing reflectivity of electrons from the surface. Now, many of the properties of the surface, such as the maximum signal that you can take out, the lag, which is the amount of signal you would get if you came back and read it again, a great part of the resolution associated with the imaging, all of these relate to the way the beam interacts with the surface and which, as we call, beam landing. In other words, the higher the beam landing efficiency, the bigger this curve, the closer it comes to zero and the sharper it drops off, the better we can put electrons on the surface and pull out video signal, the less residual signal there is, the less lag, the better resolution we can get because you don't need as much beam current to produce the signal and to reduce the lag, and then you can more tightly focus the beam. So this particular curve, which is characteristic of all of these charge storage surfaces, is fundamental. And most of the tubes, or the modern tubes, differ only in the means by which positive charge is accumulated on this storage surface. Now, if I can go back to the previous slide, I want to point out that you can get a signal out by reading the voltage across the sensing resistor. That's the typical reading process. It's called target reading. It's also possible to look at and sense the electrons scattered or elastically reflected from the target, allow these to fall into a vacuum secondary emission multiplier, and then take the signal from there, in which case it's called return beam reading or isochron reading, depending on just what kind of reflected electrons you use. So we have either signal plate reading or return beam reading as a means of generating the video signal, but in all cases, the electrons landing on the target bring it back down to this equilibrium charging potential, which is close to the cathode potential because the current is very, very low, below cathode potential. And that sort of constitutes a priming process, and then it's ready to accumulate positive charge, which raises the potential, allowing electrons to come again and put charge on the surface, creating a video signal. So that's fundamental. And so now we can go on to consider the various means by which this charge is accumulated. So if we go to the second slide, Next one. Sorry, keep going. We have one of the early types of tubes known as the orthocon. Can you reduce the size a little bit? The orthocon in the United States, the emitron in England, it has all the same elements, the decelerating mesh, charge storage target. In this case, the positive charge is created by putting a mosaic of photocathodes on the surface, light passing through the transparent backplate, transparent storage medium, creates secondary electrons, which are then attracted to this stabilizing mesh. And because they leave the surface, they leave the surface charge slightly positive. And so there is a positive charge that accumulates proportional to the incident light flux. And as you wait, the positive charge accumulates, you integrate the flux, and the integration of the flux is the basic reason why these tubes are sensitive. You sense the total flux accumulated during the interval that the beam is somewhere else. One of the disadvantages of this type of tube is the need to put the additional stabilizing mesh there. If you didn't have it, and you put too much light on the surface, it could charge well above the first crossover, and then you'd never be able to recharge it back down to the stabilization potential. And the addition of the second mesh, the reduced current, the shadow of the mesh, and so on, all of these present problems which diminish the desirability of this kind of tube. An improved version of this is illustrated in the next slide. Next slide. It's known as the image orthocon. Here, the photocathode is not a mosaic, it's a continuous photocathode. The electrons that are emitted in response to the light flux are focused by an electron optical system onto a thin, very, very thin storage plate. There is also a mesh which actually is the signal, the backplate that I referred to, and the storage volume is defined by this vacuum in here. When these electrons strike the glass plate emits several secondary electrons because the energy is a few hundred volts, and that. The difference between the secondary emission coefficient and unity represents a certain number of positive charges for each photoelectron, and that's stored on here with the storage capacitance defined by this space. That same potential variation is reflected on the front surface, and then the beam comes along and scans this off. This has enough leakage so that eventually this positive charge leaks through to the front surface, so that and one often uses a return beam reading with this case. So you get a gain from the secondary emission of this thin plate, and a gain from the secondary emission gain of the return beam reading process. Now this is a fairly complicated tube, but it's a very well-known tube. It's used very frequently in an attempt to avoid the limited quantum efficiency of the photocathode. A later version of camera tube known as the Vidicon was developed. And the Vidicon looks exactly like the second slide I showed of the storage plate, except for the fact that the photoconductor, that the dielectric medium is also a photoconductor, so that light incident on the photoconductor allows leakage to take place, and that leakage in the presence of an electric field allows positive charge to accumulate, and that's the means by which you get the positive charge, namely photoconductivity. Now, the next view graph, next slide, reviews some of the materials that have been used for this purpose. The most common one is antimony trisulfide. That's the classic one used in almost all the Vidicons for visible light. Selenium has been used earlier in the development of this type of tube. One of the problems with selenium was burn-in of optical images. Lead oxide has been used. I will come back to this, so I'm not going to point out or say anything about it at this point. Arsenic antimony triselenide has been used for infrared, lead sulfide, and combinations of lead oxide, lead sulfide. For UV sensitivity, selenium, and so on. I really want to point out that such types of tubes can have X-ray sensitivity, and selenium and lead oxide have been used for that purpose, and they have the advantage that you can make very large target areas and do relatively large area X-ray imaging. Another modification of the Vidicon has been to combine the Vidicon type of tube with the imaging section of the image orthicon, namely allow high energy electrons rather than photons to impinge on the storage plate and produce conduction by electron bombardment. And so it's called EBIC, electron bombardment induced conductivity. And here you get a gain because the electrons are energetic and you get much more conductivity than you would get from, say, photon excitation. Tubes of this type are not commonly used, although there's a variety of materials that have been used. A modification of this is one of the better known sensitive camera tubes. It's the SEC, secondary electron conduction Vidicon. In this case, the storage target is potassium chloride, and it has the characteristic that high energy electrons impinging on the material produce many, many secondaries which are collected, and so you get a gain, a secondary emission gain, directly in the storage medium. One of the nice things about this type of tube is that in the dark, the potassium chloride has virtually no conductivity, and so you can integrate flux for very, very long periods of time, and it's useful in things like astronomy, etc. One of the disadvantages is it's so fragile and so subject to destruction by extremes of light. Now, I want to return to this one, which really represented the first big step beyond the typical types of devices. This is illustrated in the next slide. Next slide, please. Here we have a storage surface, which is, rather than a photoconductor or a photocathode, really is a large area P intrinsic N-type photoconductor. Actually, it consists of many small crystallites, but from a schematic point of view, you can think of it as a large area photodiode, which has the property that there's very little leakage laterally. And the net result is that every single photon that's absorbed in this region where there's a large electric field creates a whole electron pair which is swept across, discharging the target. So this is, rather than a photoconductor, it's a photon counter, you might say. And this can have quantum efficiencies approaching 100%, whereas a photoconductor is basically very limited in that respect because there's a compromise between trying to get photoconducting gain and good storage characteristics. And the compromise really forces you into an extremely bad situation where quantum efficiencies of only a few percent are reasonably possible. You can get higher quantum efficiencies, but then at the sacrifice of high dark currents or high lag. Now, this has turned out to be one of the really fine camera tubes. It's probably predominant in color camera tubes in existence today. It has very, very low dark current. It has very good sensitivity, although it's somewhat deficient in the red. And it has very many good characteristics, along with some bad, namely the difficulty of manufacture and relatively limited lifetime. Now, that sort of brings us to the end of sort of the review of what has been. Now, I'd like to talk about the silicon camera tube, which really represents the next logical extension of this idea, but this time taking advantage of a tremendous base of technology which has been developed for integrated circuits, namely using silicon, which is really a very ideal kind of material for imaging in the visible and near-infrared part of the spectrum. Now, without talking about it so much, let me just go to the next slide and show you the configuration. Here, one uses a thin layer of crystalline silicon, typically 10 to 15 microns thick. An oxide is grown over the surface. Holes are cut in the oxide by conventional photolithographic techniques. Boron is diffused to produce a P-type silicon, so that we have an array of very tiny PN junctions. The typical dimensions of the hole are between 5 and 10 microns. The typical center-to-center spacing is 15 to 20 microns, so that the dimensions this way are about comparable to the dimensions this way. There is an additional N-plus layer formed here. I'll get back to that in a moment. And here you see one of the simplest versions, which has a feature called a resistive C, which is really just a thin layer of slightly conducting insulator over the whole array. This is usually formed by evaporation or sputtering. Now, this is really very much like the simple target I showed you. Instead of one large capacitor which has no lateral conduction, we have a myriad very small capacitors, and because they're discrete, there's no lateral conduction. The capacitance is defined by the capacitance of the diode. There's a field produced, an electric field and a depletion region produced by the fact that the substrate is held at a slight positive potential, just like in a Vidicon. The beam scans, sets this surface at cathode potential, and because there's a voltage difference between the front surface, namely the P region, and the N-type substrate, one produces a reverse bias diode. One of the difficulties with a simple structure not containing a resistor C is that the oxide, which not only serves as a diffusion mask to form the P-type regions, but also prevents the beam from striking the substrate directly and forming and producing spurious signals. That oxide is very, very highly insulating and ultimately charges below cathode potential because of the finite velocity of emission of the electrons. And as such, it can prevent electrons from landing in this region even though it might be charged positively. In other words, it acts like a coplanar negatively charged grid. So some means has to be provided for preventing this from charging too negatively, and this is one version is just to put this slightly conducting film, which as this charges negatively, allows the negative charge to leak back into the diode region and reach some reasonable equilibrium potential, which doesn't block electrons from landing in these holes. Another approach is to build up over the diode some kind of landing structure, typically called top hats or islands or lands. There are a great many ways to do this by photolithography, by electroplating, by epitaxial growth. All of these are being used in one form or the other by different proponents of this type of tube. But in any case, it gets the landing surface away from the negative region of the oxide and eases the problem. However, from sheer simplicity point of view, the resistive C reduces tremendously the number of steps and has a great bearing on the ability to produce a sort of a perfect target. One of the other nice things about the resistive C is that it allows you to independently control the landing characteristics of the surface as distinct from, say, other tubes where you sort of trying to do a lot of functions and you don't have much of a choice. And I will return to this point later on in the talk to show how you can really optimize the landing characteristics of the beam by optimizing that particular material and actually doing better than you could hope to do by many of the other techniques of building out lands and so on. One other function of the resistive C is that it acts as a protective shield for radiation, soft X-ray radiation that might be produced in the tube by the high-energy electrons landing on electrodes and penetrating the oxide and producing changes in the surface states at the interface, this produces an aging phenomena which is known as raster burn-in or electron beam burn-in, as distinct from things which would be produced by light, called optical burn-in. Now, the other speakers, I'm sure, will return to the target in considerable detail, so I don't want to dwell on it too much. I really want to address myself very briefly to this N-plus layer and point out that its function is to prevent holes and electrons which are produced in the substrate by incident radiation, either photons or charged particles, from recombining at the surface, but rather allowing them to reach the diode, discharging the diode, allowing its potential to rise. So this N-plus layer, which is very thin, typically 1,000 angstroms or so, has an important function. Also, it plays a role in the fabrication process. But the other important criterion is to make sure that any hole that's created in here reaches the space charge region and goes across and discharges the diode, rather than to be absorbed, in which case it's wasted. So that one has to make a target which has very high lifetimes for minority carriers, very low surface recombination, which is thin, so that the holes don't diffuse too far this way and diminish the resolution capability. Now, just to illustrate the optical sensitivity and the function of the N-plus layer and the thickness of the target, the next slide. I didn't mean to wake you up. You told me to tease you, okay? I'm sorry. I jumped ahead. I did want to mention one more thing about the resistive C. You can't have the resistivity too low. Otherwise, you will lose the discreteness of the diodes by leakage over the surface. And all I'm trying to illustrate here is that if you plot sort of the contrast ratio or the modulation transfer function to a sinusoidal signal versus some time interval that you allow this charge pattern to remain on the target, it does diminish the contrast ratio, but if you get the sheet resistivity of this film high enough, it's diminished very, very little in times that are relevant. So one of the requirements of this film is that it have high sheet resistivity in order to prevent loss of resolution, but it shouldn't be so high as to not serve its primary role of preventing beam, you know, of preventing this lockout or due to too low negative charge, too much negative charge on the oxide. There are other characteristics of the resistor C that you'll hear more about in the next talk, I'm sure. So next slide. This is the typical optical response, the collection efficiency, namely the number of holes that are created, that are collected per incident photon. In other words, one hole is created, one minority carrier is created if the photon is absorbed, then you have a certain ability to collect it. And here is the number, so to speak, of holes that are produced per incident photon as a function of the wavelength of the photon. So here is the curve. Well, this curve represents the maximum that you could expect to get by virtue of reflection from the silicon. The silicon has a high index of refraction. About 30% of it is reflected out here, and maybe 9% is reflected by the window of the tube, so that this is the maximum you could hope to get. You see that in the visible part of the spectrum, you get very, very close to that. In other words, virtually 100% of the holes that are created are actually collected. This fall off in this region occurs because many of the photons pass right through the target and are not absorbed. So this is just the... just how this takes place is a function of the thickness of the substrate. Thicker substrates, you'd find this curve going out further. I'd like to illustrate one particular target, the next slide, which has been optimized to do everything possible to enhance the response. Maybe it's a few mils thick. An anti-reflection coating has been put on the back. And you'll notice that the quantum efficiency exceeds 90%. Around 0.7 microns. It extends well out into the infrared. It's about 30% at 1 micron. is a really a an extreme, extremely good quantum efficiency, very, very broad spectral range. Of course, making a target that thick does sacrifice the resolution to some extent. Now, to compare it to other camera tubes of a similar kind, the next slide shows a typical silicon target, not coated, compared to the Vidicon, typical visible light Vidicon, and the Plumicon. You notice that, except for blue, where the silicon target is somewhat deficient, mostly because of reflection from the very high index of the silicon. It exceeds the Plumicon and the Vidicon by a substantial amount and extends well out into the infrared. So that we have, you see, an exceptional tube from a sensitivity point of view, and from for applications in color and for many infrared applications, it has ideal response. Now, it's also possible to have response to photons other than visible and infrared. Sorry, I'm running ahead of myself. Before I get on to that, let me just make one comment. One of the negative things about the camera tube, that slide was all right, is the fact that the dark current is very strongly dependent on the temperature. And whereas typical dark currents today run in the range of 5 to 10 nanoamps, which is less than the Vidicon, but greatly, considerably more than the Plumicon, as the temperature rises, the if you normalize it to the dark current at 25 degrees, you notice as things get hot, the dark current goes up tremendously. And a working rule of thumb is that it's also true for tubes manufactured in two different geographical locations, so it must be true, it doubles every 10 degrees. This is a problem. This isn't a problem with the Plumicon, for example, because the dark current is so low that it can stand fairly high temperatures. It's also Vidicons with antimony trisulfide have virtually the same kind of dark current increase. So it's even more of a problem with the Vidicon. Now, to go on to the next slide, what I show here, you'll have to reduce it a little bit, is the response of the target to X-ray photons as a function of the photon energy in kilovolts. And you'll notice that, say, for something of order 10 kilovolts, one gets 1,000 charges, 1,000 minority carriers for every single photon. This is because of the energetic nature of the photon, which produces a large number of charge of carriers. To illustrate why this curve falls off, we have it plotted here per keV of energy. And on that basis, if every single X-ray photon were absorbed, you'd expect to get something like 288 charged particles per keV. And that's this curve. And we don't quite reach that. And that has to do with perhaps the inefficiency of the collection process for this particular target. The fall off really occurs because above this range of energies, the X-ray photons go right on through the target. So this fall off is the same fall off that one experiences for infrared photons. The ability of the target to image X-rays with very high sensitivity, because it's very high quantum efficiency, is very useful. And to just illustrate one application of this, the next slide shows a Berg-Barrett X-ray topograph, which is taken this way. This is a silicon integrated circuit. You can hear a typical dimensions, 27 microns, 13 microns. Here is an X-ray film of the same structure. This part corresponds to this. This part corresponds to this. This is optical. This is X-ray with film. And the fact that there is imaging comes from the fact that the X-rays are highly collimated. They're scattered off the silicon by the crystalline structure in a particular direction. Where there is metal, there is no scattering, and so the metal is dark. This is silicon. Where it's light, it's because there's been a diffusion into the silicon. The silicon is diffused. It is strained. It scatters more efficiently, so it's light. And the X-rays are very well collimated. If you put the target very close, you just get a collimated image. This is the same photograph taken with a video presentation, taken with a silicon camera tube. The detail is very similar to that in the X-ray film. This is taken in a small fraction of a second. This takes many, many minutes of exposure plus development, so one can do alignment in real time. And this technique has made the X-ray topograph a practical technique, as distinct from a very laborious laboratory technique. To go on to other applications, the next slide illustrates the same target, namely the N plus, the silicon N plus, the N type silicon substrate, the diodes, and illustrates that if a charged particle, rather than a photon, passes through the target, it also can produce whole electron pairs. In this case, if you move this up, it'll say that one whole electron pair is produced for every 3.5 electron volts of energy. Now, this is true whether this is an electron, high energy electron. It's true whether it's an alpha particle or an ion of a gas or anything. One can get very, very high gains this way. Now, Bob Rogers in the last talk will discuss the use of this technique with electrons to do optical imaging, where you convert the optical flux into with a photocathode into an electron flux and then allow that to be imaged on the target. I really want to point out from historical purposes that I guess this technique was first pointed out by Bell Labs people. It probably was recognized simultaneously and independently by RCA. They were quick to capitalize on this. Toshiba in Japan was quick to capitalize on it. Both of them, very early on, demonstrated tubes using this principle. More recently, Westinghouse has demonstrated this kind of tube using targets which they purchased from the third speaker. And I think, if I understand correctly, that such a tube was the tube that was used in the last Apollo shot. And one of the advantages of this tube is that it offers to replace the SEC Vidicon in terms of sensitivity without some of the other disadvantages of the SEC target. I won't say any more than that about that. I'd like to talk about the fact that you could also image other kinds of particles. An example is, suppose this particle would be a 1 MeV, say alpha particle as an example. A very large fraction of its energy would be, it might pass through, but a large fraction of its energy would be dissipated in the target. It might produce a few hundred thousand whole electron pairs, most of which would be absorbed or collected on nearby diodes. And just that one particle would produce enough video signal so that it would produce a point of light in the image. And now you can either use it as a scintillator for imaging charged particles, or you could allow it to accumulate and photograph at a later time. The next slide is an example of that application. What we have here are helium plus ions incident on the target. They have a range of energy up to 1.2 MeV. So that the dim ones are low energy ones, the bright ones are high energy ones. They are stopped by a silicon shield so that this region here doesn't show this kind of structure, except for a small X in this region, which has been cut in the silicon so that they actually come through. So you can see an image of this X made up of individual helium ion particles. And here we have 5 MeV alpha particles coming right on through the silicon and producing points one point for each particle. So one can do in real time imaging of discrete energetic particles. I'm not going to bother to give the references. You'll find them in the digest. I think this is a very interesting application. Not only does it image, but the size of the video signal can be used to determine the energy of the particle. Now, I'd like to go on to some of the more subtle characteristics of the target now, something I promised earlier. The next slide shows a beam landing curve. This is a real-life one rather than a schematized one. Of a gallium arsenide resistive C. This was reported in the meeting in Washington, the EDM meeting in October. This is the current to the target as a function of the potential of the target. And for comparison, here is antimony trisulfide. And here is a target with these top hats with antimony trisulfide on top of it. And you'll notice that not only is the current to the target considerably greater than, say, with antimony trisulfide, which is the standard resistive C that has been used in the past, but it has a very, very steep rise. And the net result of this is that one gets very, very good beam landing characteristics. One can use lower beam currents in the tube. And one really doesn't need to use top hats with this kind of resistive C. And because it is evaporated, it goes on very easily, it's a very clean process, you have about the simplest possible target to make, and one of the best hopes for, say, defect-free fabrication. Another application is illustrated on the next slide. Here we have a fiber optic faceplate, and the target sort of stuck right on the faceplate. In this case, the optical image can be formed here and then translated onto the target by the fiber optics. And one can now put things like linear filters, stripe filters, and so on for single tube color applications. And this is becoming more and more important. And the broad spectral sensitivity and high spectral sensitivity of the silicon target is very, very important in this application. And just the fact that one could sort of make this target separately, test it separately, and stick it on. And it's not easy to stick it on. I don't want you to get that impression. But do these things independently is much more convenient than, say, evaporating, or is as convenient as evaporating. With all the advantages of the silicon target. That sort of finishes my discussion of applications and advantages and disadvantages. It's clear that the target is extremely rugged. You'll hear later that it suffers absolutely no burn-in from an optical point of view. This is very, very important. In an applications point of view, in terms of our theme of a better world, let me just give you one example. One of the difficulties with using, monitoring of parking lots or other places where it might be dangerous to be is the tremendous range of light and dark, reflections off shiny bumpers and things like that, which can really destroy typical vidicons, have no effect here. So that many of the surveillance applications become much more readily done with a silicon tube, say, than with a conventional vidicon. So you'll find that it will see more and more application in those kind of things. Of course, the cost is very important. And so what I'd like to do is sort of conclude by addressing that problem and predicting that the direction that this technology will take in the future, not necessarily in the very specialized sit tubes like Bob Rogers, but even possibly there, but in the general applications for surveillance, for single tube color cameras, and so on, will be miniaturization. And to illustrate why I think that's going to happen, I'd like to go to the next slide. Reduce that, please. And consider what happens to the various target parameters as you change its area? As I mentioned, a small problem still with the camera tube is dark current. Well, as the area increases, the dark current increases proportional to area. That I think that's obvious. And it's linearly proportional. The sensitivity of the tube is independent of the area. So from those two very important things, there's nothing wrong with making the target smaller. Very good. The resolution the resolution does get better with area, but not nearly as fast as you would think. And the next slide shows why. Next slide. What I have plotted here is the relative peak-to-peak square wave response of two commercial tubes versus the TV line number. One, a one-inch tube, that's this curve, and a half-inch tube, that's this curve. And if you look at the rest areas, half-inch by 375 mils, here just half of that, and you look at the resolution, you might think that because you've gone to half the scanned line width, that this curve would be just, fall somewhere in here, but you see it doesn't. I won't go into the details of that, but it's clear that you can optimize the design of the tube for a smaller raster. There are many advantages of going to a smaller raster. You don't lose nearly as badly in going to a smaller raster on resolution as you might think. And this is just an example of that. So that even though if you go to a larger area in the camera tube, you don't buy resolution nearly as fast as you might think, nor do you lose it when you go to a smaller area. Can I go back to the previous slide? The lag of the tube increases somewhat with area, and that has to do with the characteristics of the beam and the capacity of the diodes. And I won't go into the details, but it's a very, very slow function of area, and you don't gain much by going to reduced area, you don't lose much by going to increased area. The maximum signal doesn't really change with the area. You just optimize the diodes to have increased capacity if you have a smaller area so you can handle as much signal, and if you keep the beam current the same, you can pull out the same amount of signal. The target shunt capacity increases with area, and so there's an advantage in going to smaller areas because that shunt capacity very, very strongly determines the signal-to-noise ratio of the tube, and the smaller the shunt capacity, the better the signal-to-noise ratio. How the burn-in, namely the effect of X-rays and so on in changing the dark current, changes with reduced area, I'm leaving as a question mark. I have my own opinions, but we really haven't done any experiments. And you can argue either way and come out and be right when you do the experiment, depending on how you interpret it. The shading increases with area, so you're somewhat better with a smaller target. Now, the yield per target, I'll confine myself to these white spots I showed you on the Indian, decreases with increasing target area. Now, the second slide after this one. I plotted the yield of the target in manufacture versus the target area here in square centimeters for a triangular defect distribution with a peak of one defect per square centimeter. Now, I won't swear that this is the exact number that people will achieve, but it is a very characteristic number, and it's typical of what is achieved in manufacture, at least one location that I'm very familiar with. So what I have here is the yield versus area. The target typically for a one-inch tube is here. You can see what the yield is. If you reduce the width of the raster by two, so you reduce the area by four, you can see that the yield goes up by a factor of 2.6. For a given target that you make, for a given raster area that you make, you get 2.6 times as many targets. So that now I can go back to the first view graph, I mean the one I was looking at two before this. And if you ask how many targets per slice you can get, that is proportion, you know, inversely proportional to the area. The smaller the area, the more targets you can put on a slice. So if you, for example, talk about going to a half-inch tube, where you could reduce the raster width by half, you pick up a factor, let's say, of 2.6 on the yield per target. You pick up a factor of 4 in the number of targets per slice. And so for the same slice, the same cost in processing, you get 10 times as many good targets. In other words, you reduce the cost of making a target by a factor of 10, without really sacrificing any of the other characteristics except resolution by a small amount. I think in the face of that kind of number, I think it's clear which way the camera tube will go for many, many applications. It's going to be the miniaturized tubes and miniaturized targets. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, we'll now turn to our second speaker, Jim Matthews.